like the hot weather may be breaking. Which I think everyone will be grateful for. Every generation adds something to the complications of mankind. We started out comparatively innocent creatures. We had our moments of difficulty, but we went along pretty well probably for the first 50 or 75 million years. And since that, it's been gradually getting worse. One of the reasons it's worse, of course, is there are more of us. The second thing is, each generation has bestowed upon the future the priceless heritage of its own uncorrected mistakes. We keep right on doing the thing wrong, and the more of us to do wrong, more opportunities to do wrong, more things to get that we can't afford, more tension and stress to disturb our internal lives, and little by little, a creature that was fashioned for rather natural ways of life has reached the present impasse. We are now facing and paying, in a sense, for the mistakes of the ages. Actually, of course, this sounds rather formidable and a bit dishonest. Why should a hapless generation like ours be expected to pay for the past? Well, of course, philosophy has various attitudes on that, all the way from atheism, who says there's no reason, and that it's just bad luck, which will be corrected by doing something worse. Now, the general approach, however, from a philosophical standpoint, certainly in the Orient, is that we are the same people that did it before. That this condition that we have now is not falling on innocent heads. It is falling on those who all down through a whole cycle of embodiments have continuously made the same mistakes. In other words, we are paying for our own past and not for somebody else's. Now, when we start out with a problem, it very often looks quite simple. We feel that we can get away with a little of this, or no one will notice this or that. But actually, nothing passes unnoticed. And in the world we live in, the conduct of the individual becomes the basis of the future existence of the race. We must sometime come to this realization. In the meantime, we must face the present emergencies which summarize our own basic activity. Today we are in very complicated conditions. We are in a condition of fear, anxiety, pressure. We have many different causes for negative thinking. We realize that we are not happy, that the prospects of becoming happy are growing less likely all the time, and that we are here in the midst of an anxiety which is closing in upon nearly everyone. This anxiety is not only concerned with the life of the individual himself, but with his associates, his nation, and his world. We are becoming very fearful, very uncertain, rather pessimistic about the future of the world in which we live. Now, what seems to be the answer to this? Well, there are all kinds of answers that people have advanced, all the way from some kind of arbitration to open action and activism. But no one thinking any of these processes through carefully can consider them actually remedial. No matter what we do, we are still faced with an emergency that affects all of us. And this emergency is probably going to remain, at least in part, for the rest of our natural life expectancies. So what do? When we can't change the world, we must recognize that it is basically an educational institution. For a long time, we have believed that we live in a world which is primarily for the purpose of amusing us. It's a world in which we can enjoy things, whether we can afford them or not. A world in which we can go in debt. We can afford wars. We can continue to allow inequities and absurdities to very largely dominate our conditions. So we have to recognize that one of the reasons we are having so many anxieties is because we're not worrying about the right things. Now, it's quite possible that when we worry about the right things, we will be still very worried. But that type of worry, the better type, may impel some change in action, some modification of processes and policies that are responsible for our present state. We are looking around now with a little apprehension and remembering faintly, at least, the great hope and achievement of the Olympic Games. In simple words, we are all going for the gold. That seems to be the most important thing at the moment. And we are gradually changing the world into a vast amphitheater or coliseum, which is composed almost completely of competing people. Everyone wants to outdo somebody in something. But the things they want to have this achievement in are not the things that are necessary. We are concerned now not with outstripping our associates in their competitions, but rather finding ways to bring together in a sensible, useful manner the resources of the country and the world. Now, there are many debates on the problem of resources. One side, the optimists, say they'll always last. The other side says they're almost gone. This type of thinking again adds to our anxiety, but brings very little useful solution to us. What we must try to do, if it is possible, is to build within ourselves a kind of security which cannot be completely dominated by world conditions. In other words, as far as it is within our power, we should live as we know we ought to live in a world that is not headed in that direction. We must recognize that integrity is the only basic security that we have. And the moment we violate it, we get into trouble. Now, people will tell you that their security concepts have also gotten them into trouble, that the individual has tried to live the golden rule and has ended in bankruptcy, that it is impossible to live the principles that we believe in a world that has very little constructive psychology functioning in it at this time. But I think we still have to recognize that the individual is a unit. This individual unit, according to esoteric philosophies, has been an individual for millions and millions of years. It has its destiny in its own keeping. It comes and goes, appears and disappears, but keeps on going through uncounted ages and countless incarnations. The individual, therefore, is a being that must ultimately take control of its own life, its own purposes, its own integrities, must live as it should regardless of consequences, and live as harmlessly as possible, always looking for new ways of cooperating rather than new ways for excelling our neighbors. If we are individuals, if we have our own destiny in our own keeping, and it seems that we must, because we observe occasionally an individual who takes control of his own destiny and does something about it, and these are the heroes and unforgettable characters of the human race. Now, in the anxiety patterns as we have them today, we have to settle down to consider the cause of the anxiety in ourselves. Most people, I think, will admit that the main cause of anxiety at the moment is insecurity. It is the inability of the individual to have the things that he wants to have or believes he is entitled to. It is also true that his wants today are far greater than ever before, and there are more and more people with more and more wants. And this further complicates our entire pattern of civilized relationships. Most people claim, most thoughtful people claim, to have some concept of religion. They may not agree in creedal particulars, but they do have a sense of awareness that there is a power beyond themselves that must govern the destinies of existence. Whatever it is and wherever it is, it represents a supreme purpose. Whatever created this condition in the universe, or created the universe for this condition to arise in, has a purpose. There is a reason for existence. If the individual is able to bring his inner resources together and begin to contemplate this reason, it may help him to recognize that the infirmities and anxieties that affect him are in a sense unreasonable. We know, for instance, that people are convinced, many millions of them, that deity knew what it was doing when it fashioned this plan. And somewhere there is a supreme power that is just, reasonable, intelligent, and useful. That this power has ordained a creation and created it, and has gradually guided its destiny through millions of years. The individual, most people, of the 2.5 billion whom we know to be committed to some type of religion, we know that these people affirm that deity knew what it was doing. And most of them will be willing to admit that we do not know what we are doing. Now, this interval has to be crossed in some practical way. For the average religionist, one of the keys to this problem is faith. We may not know all the answers to everything, but if we have faith in the ultimate victory of good over evil, truth over error, life over death, we realize there is a purpose, and that in some way our own peace of mind and peace of heart depends upon agreeing with and advancing this purpose. If we go against it, our anxieties increase. Nearly all of the anxieties that we know today are based upon the selfishness and arrogance and unthoughtfulness of our fellow human beings. We know that this is a mistake and a danger. But we also have the opinion that we should be allowed to do as we please, regardless of consequences. The moment we are invited to economize, we will vote that officer out of office. We all know that everyone but ourselves should be better. We all know that everyone except ourselves should be good-natured. That we also, all but ourselves, have no right to their actions, many of them, but that we always have a right to ours. Now, this forms a rather technical tangle, and there is no immediate answer to just how to untangle this situation, except by gradually coming to the realization that selfishness on any level is contrary to the good and survival of a civilization. Now, selfishness at the top creates a vast system of wealth. Selfishness at the base or at the bottom creates a vast system of discontent. This discontent largely is a result of looking up and seeing the wealth. This combination is too much for us. It always has been. I think in years and years ago, a long time ago, the Japanese had a very interesting answer to this. They were a country that for 250 years prior to the arrival of Peary managed to live together without a war, or without fighting anybody else. Now, the secret of this was the strategy of the Tokugawa shogunate. The great center of wealth in Japan at that time was the city of Osaka, which was where the merchants, the traders, the bankers, the speculators, the stockbrokers had their headquarters. Now, they kind of felt themselves to be sort of special people. They had wealth and lots of it. And every turn time they turned around, they added a few more million yen to their treasuries. And Ieyasu Tokugawa, looking at this for a little while, observed what he considered to be a serious mistake. The men were down in Osaka were dressing in the most expensive materials possible. Their homes were the most gorgeous possible. They were putting everything into a great show, and they were always followed by at least two retainers with two swords for no particular purpose, because there was no war at that time, but it was part of the great glory of the moment. The ladies of the family were dressed in the most elaborate silks and satins that money could buy. The Japanese didn't have any jewelry such as we have. Most of their jewelry was made of bamboo, so that wasn't much of a factor. But they had their hair done most magnificently, and their faces powdered white until they looked like walking Carrara marble. And they really made quite a show of all this. So Ieyasu in Edo, now Tokyo, looked it over and he said, "This isn't so good. Here we have in these islands many millions of people who do not live in Osaka and are not in this state. They are farmers, agriculturists, small business people, and things of this nature. We cannot and must not allow a display of wealth on one hand to cause us to forget that all of this wealth is utterly, ultimately in rice. And the rice farmers are the ones who make all our money for us. Then we do other things with it." So Tokugawa said to his officers, and they always did what he told them, because if they didn't, they weren't there long. He said, "Go down there and tell them to take off all this glory. Move into simple homes. Get rid of all these ostentations of wealth. No more publicity about how much they make or how much they have. Tell them to live like ordinary people so that they will not cause ambitions that cannot be fulfilled to rise in the hearts and minds of our subjects." So, in a few days, it all disappeared down in Osaka. Because if it didn't disappear, the culprit disappeared and was not seen again. Now comes the trick. And that is that the desire for this ostentation didn't die. The bankers and all the wealthy people were dressed in sober black. They walked very sedately. They made no show of wealth. But on the lining of every garment was filled with gold thread. They had the most expensive things, but they didn't show. This went on for a while, but after a while, I think Tokugawa saw one of them, and more restrictions were placed. But the whole thing sums up in the fact that when some have too much and others have too little, social disruption is inevitable. And this was something they found out in the early years of the 17th century. Now, we have the same problem here today. Part of our discontent is not that we do not have what we need, but that we do not have all that we want. And I believe it was Socrates who observed on one occasion that there are two ways of becoming wealthy. One is by having more, and the other is by needing less. And the survival of our civilization is going to depend upon the gradual emergence of a moderate attitude toward wealth. We are going to have to get to the point where we no longer are envious of everyone who has more than we do. And it isn't now so difficult to get over this envy when we realize the miserable condition of the wealthy. They are more miserable than we are. But as one person said rather meaningfully, if we must be miserable, it is perhaps more pleasant to suffer from the miseries of wealth. But it's not necessarily so. These young people on heroin and other narcotics, the infidelities the extravagances seemingly have very little reward, and in the long run, and not always a long run, these extravagant people dig their own graves. It's not so much, therefore, of an advantage to seemingly have more than we need. Now the question is, what do we need? And in this, I think it's very interesting to go back to the utopians of the 16th and 17th century, beginning with More's Utopia, Campanella's City of the Sun, André's Christianopolis, and Bacon's New Atlantis. These were the 17th century utopias. In the 18th century, the temper changed. Humanism was rising, and the utopia was no longer a going institution in some remote place. It was now a desert which the individual had to cultivate for himself. But in the 17th century utopians, there was very great emphasis upon basic integrities. And these imaginary but very plausible communities, mostly strongly Lutheran by persuasion, actually set up patterns that could have and did have for a long time considerable influence in modern thinking and helped to lead to what we might term the universal reformation of knowledge. These utopians are all socialized commonwealths. They were institutions in which all equalities were bestowed upon possessions. The individual could not gain power through wealth. On the other hand, there was every inducement for the individual to improve, grow, and become famous, useful, important, and remembered because of the development of his internal life. In other words, the one place where there was no competition was in the rapidity with which the individual can improve himself. This is not competitive. And to do this, a certain common generosity, a certain universal integrity, had to be the governing factor. Most of these utopias, in fact all of them, were religiously dominated. But in their religious domination, they took the socializing aspect of Christianity and applied it to the physical problems of living. In other words, they were building a commonwealth or a world that was based upon the integrities of basic Christianity as it was taught by Jesus, but not necessarily exemplified by the church. It was the basic human factor. If you love God, love one another. This dominated the utopians. Now, some of this utopian world would seem very stuffy today, and it was even then. But at the same time, it inspired the individual to realize that the greatest contribution that he could make to the continuance of civilization was to become civilized himself in his own lifetime. That by doing this, he was laying the foundation for the future. Every family that raised children in the utopian community was actually expanding the utopia. Comenius in his educational system, which was part of the utopian scheme, was convinced that in order to progress civilization, every child's moral code, ethical code, spiritual conviction, and dedication had to be bestowed upon him before he entered the public school. In other words, his inner life was governed by his family. If the family was wrong, he was wrong. If he resisted the family, it was a mistake. On the other hand, if the family neglected him in any way, shortchanged his needs, became selfish as mature persons, and paid less attention to the young, or were mentally or emotionally unequipped to teach the young properly, any case of this kind would spread out and in the course of 1,000 years would disastrously affect thousands of new generations. It had to start at what Comenius called the mother school. Here was taught the gentle virtues, the kindly attitudes, the honesties and integrities of life. These were imparted before the child learned to read or write. They were the cultural heritage to which every young person coming into this world is entitled. Lacking in this, they can try in schools and in universities to make up this loss if it is not applicable to the home life. But if it's too late, the twig is bent and the tree will be inclined from then on. So if you want an honest world, start by dedicating efforts to the making of honest young people. Doing so by instructing them yourself, if you are have a family. And also, in the instruction of them, remember, as Comenius said, no amount of instruction is valuable unless it is supported by the evidence of personal action. In other words, the individual must teach by living better himself. The child will not be influenced constructively by being told to be good by parents who are making no effort to improve their own characters or natures. So as it all works out, we have gradually inherited this mess, largely because people have come to the conclusion that they were here to advance their own destinies. They were here to accumulate, dominate. They were here to become leaders of nations. They are here to fulfill all kinds of personal ambitions. And in our generation, most of these ambitions have strong financial overtones. So living in this world is not easy. And most people didn't get the kind of start they should have had. But if they didn't, then if possible, they should recognize the importance of a universal reformation of themselves. They should realize that it is their privilege and power to pick up and improve the standards of their living the moment they realize that this is necessary. If they don't know that it is necessary, adversity has not yet had its perfect work in them. But the moment we know that we should do certain things, that there are purposes in life that are neglected for lesser purposes, and as soon as we know this, we must try to take charge of our own problems. Now, we have all of us, and most professional counselors and clergymen, are constantly deluged by people who are suffering from the tensions of adversity. They regard themselves as abused, neglected. They consider their lives ruined by incidents that have occurred perhaps 50 years earlier. They live in under a tremendous cloud which gradually closes in as a great pessimism, a sense of futility, which may in turn be backed finally by a belligerence in which they turn desperately upon the environment which they feel have injured them. This is the way it goes in this world, but there has to be something done about it. And the only way it can be done is that the individual, either through pain or through wisdom, must find his own place in a proper state of consciousness. Now, actually, we know, every psychiatrist knows, that these negative attitudes, these constant feelings of being abused or neglected, or that others are having opportunities that do not come to us, or that we are not appreciated for the merits which we possess, all these thoughts constantly have a strong effect upon the physical health of the individual. There is no doubt in the world that the constant nursing of the sense of adversity in the life of the person will lead to physical deteriorations which will still further lower the optimistic reflexes of the mind. The more sorry we are for ourselves, the more of ourselves we really have a right to be sorry for, because it keeps on building up until there seems to be no answer. Now, actually, there is a certain sense of penetration that if we are thoughtful, we can change an attitude without necessarily changing the facts involved at all. I think Socrates is probably one of the great exponents of this concept when he showed his disciples a glass half full of water. Now, he said that there are two kinds of people in the world who will look at this glass half filled with water. One will say the glass is half full. The other will say the glass is half empty. Now, the pessimist is the one who says it's half empty. The optimist says it's half full. And in both cases, the actual amount of water remains the same. Therefore, there is some way in which we can find things half full that we have long held to be half empty. In fact, this is the beginning of what might be termed a better way of life. Now, what will we do to find this idea in ourselves? How can we develop the habit of realizing that things are really, basically, considerably better than we think, and that we ourselves are destroying our own optimism? Well, one way, of course, is to stop listening to television reports and cancel your newspapers and just simply go take a vacation somewhere. Because everything today here is emphasizing the tragedy. We are doing nothing but recounting the cruelties and inhumanities of man to man. Well, a lot of it's true. And we know it's true. And we have to look at it and say to us, how can we reconcile conditions as they are with a benevolent universal purpose? How can we say that we believe in God and then find that we believe in a God that can't do anything? That's probably the reason why he's always having so many people helping him, and as a result of the helping, things get worse and worse. Actually, either the power is there, either this plan is purposed and working, or it isn't. Now, if we look carefully into the human pattern, we will realize that essentially, humanity is sound. We are not a completely degenerate race of creatures getting ready to go back and swing in the jungle. We are really mostly well-intentioned people. We are intentionally inclined to be kind, to be thoughtful, and to be generous. When an emergency strikes our community, we all get together and do what we can to help it. And then when the emergency passes, we go on competing with each other for something. So there is a strong basic fabric here in this world of people who would like to do it right, who want to be good people, who want to be friendly, kindly, and generous, who want to support problems and principles which they feel are important. Time after time, vast charities are dedicated to purposes essentially intended to improve society. But these very often run afoul of exploitation and their virtues die. But there is a basic ground here of people who want to do it right. There are also a great many people who recognize right when they see it and are not deceived by wrong, but are not of themselves strong enough to face the situation. Exploitation is based largely upon catering to the cupidity of people. The individual who has many wants will be the victim of exploitation as long as he lives. The individual who has few wants, we like the story that is told about a salesman, and this is a true story, by the way, who tried to sell ice boxes to the mountain people of Peru, way up there in the Andes. And they were interested. They looked at them and shook their heads. And he told them they could get them for a dollar down and all the offerings, that they could pay a little bit and have the machine insured for profit by the year and all that. And they told these natives what the price was. And they said, "We don't have the money." Wells is the man. We can arrange credit for you. You know. So, finally, he was absolutely unable to do anything with these people. So he sent a telegram back to the head office, which read like this. He said, "Cannot sell ice boxes here. People suffer from damned wantlessness." Well, that's an ailment you don't hear much about these days. Everybody wants everything. But these people, these natives who hadn't passed into the aura of higher civilization, just would not go into debt. The Greeks found that out. Lycurgus found that out long before the Christian era. The Hindus have found it. The Chinese know it. The Greeks and the Egyptians knew it. Everybody has known it. But they haven't the courage. They cannot get away from the glamour of fulfilling their wants. So one thing the individual can do to lower his anxieties is to divide sharply between his wants and his needs, and allow a little extra for his wants, but not too much. If we were not extravagant, dishonesty throughout the business world would drop very rapidly. It is the cupidity of the individual that supports the unfairness of the moving institutions of our day. So one thing we can do is to lower the tension that comes from being unable to afford that swimming pool right now, or to get along a little longer without the 100-inch television screen. Incidentally, many people are wondering if the programs will just look larger and worse if they get the 100-inch skin. It will have nothing to do with the merit of the picture, and that is applicable to many fields. Getting it more and bigger doesn't make it any better. And this situation has existed for the last 50 years with desperate consequences. Always there's been worries, but many of them were something that grandfather himself could solve. Now governments can't solve them because of the selfishness of people. So to get over anxiety, make a careful list of the things that are causing anxiety. Whether it is unhappiness, self-pity because you don't have as large a house as your neighbor, or do not drive an expensive car, or haven't yet been quite able to get that $40,000 camper, see whether or not you need it. Find out what you are doing to get yourself into this kind of problem. And realize that sometimes this extravagance is simply an effort to run away from yourself. You can't live with yourself any longer, so you start on a larger journey. But nothing happens. Get down and think through the actual problems of your life. If you solve the economic aspects with some efficiency, it will largely reduce the rest, because it is mostly to have, to get, that is giving us the trouble. So think it through and see what your attitudes can be on the values of things, the real values. Now, another point that will help to understand the problem of adversity is to sit down very quietly and say what you really want to do with your life. Have you any worthwhile aspirations? Would you like to be better in any way that you are now? And always putting a censorship on the fact that the motive must not be economic. The motive must be personal. If you have some ability, some gift, some consecration, some skill or some knowledge that you feel is important, then the problem is to begin to lean more heavily upon the development of these internal resources and less heavily upon pleasure, which is supposedly the base of happiness. The individual is more happy fulfilling himself than he can ever be by what he can accumulate. And now, with the present pattern of things, accumulation is a misery on the spirit. We do not know from moment to moment whether we have anything or nothing. But whatever we develop in personal resources, we will have. One of the problems of this also is the fact that so many human beings today cannot get along with themselves. The moment they're alone, they're miserable. They have to have some kind of a way of getting themselves off of their own minds. The moment they sit down, they're either lonely or neglected or irritated or disconsolate. Always they must be busy. Busy doing what? For large measure, things that are not of any importance whatever. But they just get our minds off our troubles, as one person told me. Well, it isn't so much getting the mind off of troubles that's going to solve the problem. It's getting the mind working on the problems and on the troubles to see what can be done about them. So if we begin to realize the nature of the kind of world we live in, if we can gain a number of very interesting inducements. One of the interesting points is that we are all of us working desperately to accumulate something which we cannot have proprietorship over for more than a few years. The individual who has done everything possible to be comfortable in this world, and in doing so has neglected every other consideration, will in a short time just simply fade away from this world, leaving his wealth for his relatives to sue each other for, and he himself goes out into a dismal uncertainty for which he is in no way prepared. I have had many deathbed scenes, and for the most part, those who die with greatest comfort and pleasure and sincere integrity are the ones who haven't too much. The more they have, the more they worry, and the more they worry, the more they try to bury their fears and anxieties, although perfectly aware that they are simply contributing to the delinquencies of their descendants. There's no other attitude to it. So the person who is desperately trying for that extra 10 million should wonder whether or not it is worth what it is doing to him. If he has what he needs, if he can cultivate simple pleasures and has certain mental activities and is improving himself through the arts, through literature, through study, through various trades and techniques, this individual is mostly the happy one. I had a friend years ago who went to retirement at 65, and it was a marvelous experience. Instead of settling back to try to live on their investments or something of that nature, they simply got into a new activity. For all their lives, this person had wanted to become an herbalist. They wanted to study the healing powers of herbs. After retirement, they lived 20 years working with their involvements and studies with herbalism, and left behind documents of great value to the science of medicine. Now, this person was not much interested in wealth. They could have sold these things, but they had enough to live on, so all that they learned was given without charge or cost to scientific institutions.